and welcome to the Spirit Guide Society podcast. My name is Pedro Shanahan, and I'm your spirit guide. Tonight in the Whiskey Society at 7 Grand in downtown Los Angeles, we had Josh Allen in the house with Pindaren Whiskey. What is Pindaren? It's a Welsh whiskey. Yes, whiskey from Wales. It was an incredible night, a really great education from Josh. Be sure to check it out. Tell your friends about our podcast who want to learn more about the spirits that they love. And always remember to enjoy this podcast responsibly. That means don't start telling everybody that you're the expert. Nobody knows as much as you because you're a big, fat whiskey snob. Nobody likes that person, okay? Keep it humble. And Josh is here to teach us about the Pindaren line of whiskeys, which, if you were not familiar with this brand, it's a Welsh whiskey. So, as far as I know, the only whiskey from Wales that's currently available in Southern California, or maybe in most of the United States. Is that true, Josh?
That is it.
In America.
In America, in Wales, in Europe as a whole, in Asia, and yeah, they've branched out. It's available in a lot of places now, and it's changed a lot. If you're at all familiar with how they started out, production took a serious turn not too many years ago.
Turn up or turn down?
Yeah, they were like, fuck it, we're down. They're as far as like literature on single malt that is out there, like some of the sort of Scotch encyclopedia type publications, as it were, that exist. The notes you'll find on Pindaren, if it was published before 2013, 2014, are going to be inaccurate for what's going on now. When Pindaren started in 2004, it was a bunch of drunk Welsh dudes in a pub going like, we should make whiskey too. I don't know if that's their accent. I have no idea. When Pindaren started out, what they were doing was sourcing a locally made beer to create their wash to ferment from. And please, like, if what anything that I say doesn't make sense, make me stop and explain it. And if I can't explain it, throw things at me. Like, it's fine. So that's what they were doing. They had no mash tun at the distillery. The stills that they were using, everything has taken a hard turn and a change since then. In 2013, they installed their own mash tuns. Everybody familiar with what I'm talking about there? So they're making their wort, the beer that they are using to then distill and make their whiskey with. It is all done on premise now, 100%. And I was just talking to Pedro about this before we started, and it's confusing. Pindaren is using a process that is very much proprietary. They have a still, it's called a Faraday still, because the engineer that designed it is named Dr. David Faraday. If you're history buffs at all, I'm just gonna throw this out there. He is a direct descendant of Dr. Michael Faraday, who was a Victorian era scientist who is largely responsible for things that is sort of intrinsic to our process of mineral ore at this point. Like he pioneered the process that allowed us to be able to separate pure elements from the ore that they're found in, like take the junk out of the, I'm talking about way back. This has nothing to do with alcohol. I'm just throwing this as a way back. But he's a direct descendant and very much an engineer. So the Faraday still that they are using to do this is very unique. Now, there are a lot of new distilleries. What we were talking about before is that there are a lot of these hybrid stills that are coming out in whiskey production now. And by that, I mean that there are these pot stills. And, if you understand sort of a little bit about like craft spirit production, pot stills always sounds a little bit sexier than column still. The column still was a later invention that allowed for high rectification and kind of like when you think of a big market, high volume whiskeys that are produced fast and easy, you think of the column still, and the pot still is kind of the the sexier way of going about it. Just by that, I mean a lot of the time there's direct heat on the metal. It's not as easily controlled. It is a heavier, more flavorful spirit. Maybe a lot of that's marketing. I guess it really depends on who's running the still. But more and more in craft spirit production now, especially some of the works in the business, what I'm seeing is these hybrid stills that are coming more and more in vogue. And what that means is, yes, there's a single pot still involved, and a lot of classic Irish or Scottish malts are using a double pot still or even triple distillation in a pot still. It's a single pot still, and on top of the still, there is a small column of, in this case, I believe, 6 plates atop, and then there is a whole other column separate from the still with, I think, 12, so a total of like 18 plates that are used in the distillation of this particular product. What that means is the heavy spirit that's produced in the pot goes through a series of plates in a column still, which means the vapors are evaporating up and then reflux is coming back down, and it's going back up and coming back down and going back up and coming back down over and over and over and over again, which essentially exists to eliminate undesirable elements from your whiskey. Now, there's always this argument about column still and how, you do that, what's called high rectification, and you eliminate a lot of what's flavorful, desirable.
What's perhaps the difference between whiskey and vodka? You go too high with the rectification and you're not making whiskey anymore, you're just making vodka.
Right. So if you are rectifying, distilling to a high enough proof that it strips out to be a grain spirit, that's what you have. You have a base neutral grain, which is what vodka is. You might add botanicals to it, which is what gin is. Well, in this case, they're using a process and a still that is unique to them, and they are actually distilling this spirit to 92% ABV. That's unheard of for whiskey. Bourbon, for instance, is generally distilled to 160 proof or 80% alcohol by volume. You're going to bottle it different than that. Not necessarily. I mean, it could be a cask strength. But that aside, with Penderyn, they are distilling a whiskey through this process where the flavor is not all stripped out. This particular process, it's not creating a grain alcohol. They're able to distill to proof that high, and they're also saying that they don't have to make any cuts because of the process, which is,
I don't know how that's possible.
I don't either. He's raising a really good question.
You have to, like what I was saying is, I can understand maybe using some of your heads, but your heads are going to be kind of the most volatile. You know, you don't even want to put those in a barrel because they're going to taste like acetone and all these like really gnarly chemicals. But at some point, you have to make a tail cut because that's where you're turning
what's
off
just
his
left
still.
In the...
Yeah, I mean, you can't just run your still until it's bone dry. That's going to screw up your equipment. So you have to make a tail cut at some point. Even if you like the flavors that are coming out at the end of the batch, you have to turn off the pot, you know?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me from what I know about everything else about whiskey.
And then, and in my understanding is if you're coming off the still that hot, then it is grain alcohol by definition. Whiskey can't be coming off the still any hotter than 165 or it won't retain the character of the base agricultural product, which is what whiskey is. The difference between whiskey and vodka is that you can identify the base agricultural product that it's made from. That's why we love it. We know that we're drinking something that's made out of barley. You know, like that's, we can identify it with our tongues. That's the key part of whiskey. You can make vodka out of potatoes. You can make it out of rice. You could make it out of sugar. You could make it out of grass, rye. But you're distilling it so hot that it doesn't matter because you're stripping away any identity. When something comes off the still, my understanding of it, chemically speaking, is that if it's coming off the still at like 180, then it would have no fusel oils in it that would allow the bioflavonoids to attach themselves to it. You need to have some oils in there, like fats or how flavors attach themselves. They need to have something to grab onto. So that's just my experience. Maybe I'm wrong, but this guy's he's descended from a great chemist, so maybe somehow they're playing around with some new
I want to tell you that he's wrong.
Of.
He's not wrong. No, all of my interaction with them is like they're talking about a process that doesn't exist for whiskey. Now, I work with some whiskeys that come out of Japan that are Koji fermentation and are a single pass and a column still. And they make no cuts because when you use Koji malt for fermentation, there is no ethanol produced and it doesn't matter. But they're not distilling to 184 proof. Mm-hmm. So it's confusing and it sounds crazy to me, but they tell me this over and over again. They're like, we're not making any cuts. This is the distillation. These same questions have come up where they're saying it's just a matter of how much reflux and the copper and the still inherently that everything that you need to be eliminated is eliminated and we don't make any. So I want to just go with what they're telling me.
Somebody's
not
wrong
the first
there.
Time I've been lied to.
Somebody doesn't have the story straight because if it was just that, then it would be, if it's just about the copper, then they wouldn't even need to run the still that hot. It, apparently the still would clean up your whiskey a lot. You could run it even cooler, get more yield, which would be more cost effective. So it just brings up a lot of questions for me.
It does.
But as we do, as the more I learn about whiskeys often, you know, Paul and Natalie go to distilleries and you walk out of a distillery sometimes with more questions than when you walked in.
Because yeah, the last meeting that I had with them, we kept going, how do you make no cuts? And they're like, we make no cuts. And I was like, I don't understand. And that's how that ended. I'm going to go with what they're telling me, and I'm going to tell you. I honestly would like to have a better chemical explanation for that. But this first expression that you're tasting is what is called Penderin Legend. This is very much indicative of their house style. You talk in general, their house style is a very light-bodied, fruity whiskey. While a lot of the barreling is bourbon barrel, specifically a lot of the sourcing comes from Buffalo Trace. They also do a bit from Evan Williams. Evan Williams was actually Welsh as part of whatever. Buffalo Trace is not. I don't know what to say. It's just a high-quality bourbon. What are you going to say? They'd spend some time being finished in Madeira cask. Is everybody familiar with Madeira and what that is? I don't want to just leave that behind if that's not a thing, right? This is a Portuguese 45.
Don't be shy. Raise
one.
Your hand if you don't know any of this. Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah. Learning experience.
That's right. That's right.
This is at 86 proof. There's this influence on a lot of it.
So some bourbon casks, a little bit of Madeira casks, so that a European red wine cask finish. But this is their base expression now. This is what the classic of the line is.
This is.
I don't think I've had this. I haven't tried this whiskey in over a year, so this is some different stuff. So this is the Penderin Legend, and a lighter style. I can tell by the noise. It does remind me of grain alcohol spirit on the nose.
This is subdued compared to one of the later ones that we're gonna, but like a huge pop of tropical fruit note. It's here and it's subdued here, but it's much more prevalent in one of the other ones.
This doesn't have an age statement on it, right?
No, that's actually a great point. There are no age statements, as I said. I mean, they've only been in production since 2004, and these particular ones have only been in production since 2013.
Okay.
So what you're drinking is approximately a four-year-old.
Four and each, and then blended together.
Yes, okay. and the couple of last ones are about a year older than that, but everything is no age statement and young.
So younger in the style of Scotch, but this is from Wales.
This is Wales.
So geographically, where is that in relation between London and Edinburgh? Where does this land? You know.
Yeah, if you look at a map of the UK. It kind of looks like a kangaroo. I always thought that about the UK. Like if you look
at it,
it's
on the northeast side, right?
Like if you look at the map, like there's kind of a kangaroo. If you think of the backpack, that's Wales. I don't know why a kangaroo would have a backpack, but I'm just throwing that out there.
They have front packs actually. they wear pouches in front,
and that's there on the map. But like the spot that you could separate off the back. I mean, it's a small country, a small population, a rich history. I mean, I don't know that the kangaroo analogy is a good one. I'm sorry. Well, I was just saying that Wales, if you look at a map of the UK, Wales is on the west. Yeah, I wasn't saying that Wales is the pouch.
You just really need to know which way your kangaroo is facing. Okay? You know what I'm saying?
Wow. That's fantastic.
It's very important. So stick your nose in this glass, breathe in gently through your mouth. So when a grain spirit, when we talk about a light style, what does that mean for you? All right? I mean, because we can come up with turns all day long, but everybody has their own experience.
Tequila presence.
Like a verdant note. When you say tequila, I think agave-based spirits for me are verdant and green. I get like a vegetal.
I'm getting honeydew.
Honeydew.
Yeah, like melons. Well, I mean, on the nose, I got like coconut cream, lychee, but on the palate, I'm getting like honeydew all the way, like sweet melon.
I was getting some like some banana, and then like I get that charred pineapple, like pineapple that you put on the grill. Mm-hmm. So it's got a little caramelized sugar in there as well. From the pineapple?
It's just like
green bananas. Okay, that's good, that's good.
Yeah, what'd you think about this first one? What were you getting on it?
I just get alcohol and it tastes good.
Yeah, John.
That's totally acceptable, absolutely. It's alcohol and it tastes good. All right, so tap some over your tongue. So once you've nosed it, expose your entire tongue to this spirit. Natalie, what are you getting on this one?
The best, so imagine like in elementary school, you get like the fruit cocktail out of the can. But like the best fresh fruit cocktail that I've ever had. Yeah.
Interesting.
A lot of fruit.
Oh, interesting. I'm definitely getting a banana, like a green banana thing, and maybe some coffee on the finish. But it's...
I'm always impressed and enamored by female palates, because my wife is not a whiskey person per se, and I'll be like, oh, taste this, we just got this, like taste this. And I'm going like, God, what is that? And she's like, I just get like mango on that. And I'm like, God damn, that is mango. Fuck.
She's good. Really good.
But that is a good point, just because it is actually a important thing to note. The entire distilling team at Pendaren is female. The master distiller, the master blender, like it's an entirely female team, which was not like. They weren't specifically trying to do that. They just were vetting people out, and these three women were the ones they were like, yeah, it's them. It's going to be them. Yeah, so it's what you would, I think, maybe call a feminine whiskey because of how light and nuanced it is, and at the same time, it's women making it. So
it also reminds me, it's a little bit like an Irish style to me.
Lighter?
That lighter style likens more to traditional Irish style whiskey, a little bit more isopropyl, a little bit more fruity and light. It lends itself more to kind of like an Irish style. And if we're thinking, if it's down in the Southwest, that means it would be closer to Ireland and definitely might have some of those characteristics, just being Dublin being a port town, like some exchange of that same kind of knowledge, in the same way that the lowland Scotches liken themselves in style a lot more toward the Irish style, just because they're closer to Dublin, and Dublin was where they were originally shipping most of the whiskey out of in the old world. It's kind of like the capital of the early industrialization of the whiskey making process. So you guys all now have the second mark in your hands, and this is called Pendaren Myth, which means that this whiskey doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's it.
No, I don't. Why is it called the Myth?
It sounded cute.
Hmm.
No, I don't know. You'll notice. I mean, it's everything about the branding is very much tied to Wales. If you've ever seen the flag, I mean, the red dragon, Pendaren. If you look at the other two bottles that are here, this trace here is about like Welsh gold, which is very rare, as much as their whiskey is what they're saying. I mean, it's all very much tied to the culture.
That's cool.
So,
and what I've understood is, like, I mean, I've been working out in the front bar before and had folks from Wales come in, and Welsh folks are like, "Ah, oh, Pendaren, you have it. We must drink it," you know. And that's just, they're very hardcore about loving the whiskey from Pendaren.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's a tiny little, I mean, there's, you know, it's a tiny little country. I mean, just for example, the collection of like Welsh surnames in the U.S., which would be like Evans, Williams, Jones, like there are more Americans with those surnames than there are the entire population of Wales. You know what I mean? Allen is my last name, is a Welsh name. That's an Ellis Island name. My people came over from Russia. It has nothing to do with that. That's just what they got named. But It's just that there are a lot of like really common white names in the U.S. You know what I mean? That's just is what it is. And there isn't a whole lot to it. I mean, these are people that were, like so many other places in the world, colonized by the Brits. And they were like, you know, fuck you guys. I don't really know what to say. I mean, like, and it's still just like these things that they're holding on to with their culture. And, you know, like I said, the ownership of the brand in 2004 was like, they always made whiskey here before. Why can't we do it again?
So now the myth, what was the twist on it? How is it different from the legend?
So myth is a lot of, I don't know the answer to that question. It actually is, that's funny. Slightly, the punch that you had is actually myth in it. But the process by which myth was created involved Well, Puff the Magic Dragon, and I mean, look at it. No, the whiskey and myth is a combination. It's vatted whiskey that was either entirely matured in bourbon cask, like a lot of it is, or red wine cask. It's just a special selection of red wine barrels. And this isn't a vatting that's then finished a red wine cask. It's equally matured in both and then vatted together.
Mm-hmm. So slightly different blend from the legend, because the legend you said had some Madeira on it, which is a red wine as well. So this is kind of a different blend.
Yeah, and there is, like, you can tell through the house style, like, there's no missing the fact that this is still the same people making this whiskey. Mm-hmm.
All right, so stick your nose in this glass and breathe in gently through your mouth. What comes to mind? What are you reminded of as you smell this whiskey? Paul, have you gotten the myth back here?
I'm done with it.
Actually, oh my, moving fast.
Acorn and soft grass.
Soft grass. I'm getting some red fruit character though on this one. I almost smell something like a dark red fruit, like a pomegranate or a cranberry, something like dark red in there. And more vanilla. Yeah, floral, more vanilla than the first mark.
Yeah.
So tap it over your tongue. Think about structure, think about architecture. How does this linger across your tongue? Does it have a really heavy front end? Does it have a really light finish? I mean, think about the arc of it in your mouth, you know?
Yeah, it's literally, like, there's definitely nothing that resembles, I mean, I'm a fan of a lot of Scotch single malts that are heavy and oily and a lot of bottom to them, right? And these are not those.
I'm getting some citrus though. Somebody got burnt orange peel on the finish on this one. What are you guys getting back here? Share your experience. Yes. Mulberry. Okay, great. That's great. Unusual berry, but I get what you're saying, like dark red fruit. I mean, there's so many ways to think about smelling and tasting. So when I talk about architecture, I'm thinking of a bridge from the front of your palate toward the back. And sometimes if a whiskey is maybe not mature, sometimes it feels like there's planks missing in your bridge where the front is structured well, it starts to taste like maybe it starts off with like a light tropical fruit note and then it arcs and it starts to gain body and it seems like it's getting into a caramel thing and then it might taste a little watery for a second and then it finishes with kind of a brackish or a leathery kind of linger. Now that to me is like there's something wrong with that arc. It doesn't have a consistency from beginning, middle to end. So I look for that in whiskeys. I mean, maybe that doesn't make any sense to you, but that's just my experience. Everyone's experience is going to be different. So I try to kind of judge the architecture and how does the whiskey begin and middle and end go across your palate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
There's a biological imperative to your generally you have a lot of different kinds of taste buds on your tongue. We're taught in elementary school that your sweet taste buds are on the front, your bitter taste buds are in back, your sour in the middle, your salty on the sides, and then your umami is your ability to create, to detect protein, and that's all over. Thank you, Natalie. But that's the oversimplification, because depending on your genetic background, you might have more or less taste buds. Some people might have like, you know, hundreds of taste buds or thousands of taste buds, while other folks might have much less. So everyone's experience is going to be different. I don't want to oversimplify it, but there is a biological imperative to having at least some clusters of sweet tasting taste buds on the front of your tongue, because if you think about it,
when we were hunters and gatherers and we were adapting to all these different foods as we were still nomadic, we needed to know what was poison. Generally speaking, fruits that are safe to eat are gonna be sweet. And so your tongue would have the sweet taste buds on the front, and right away you'd be able to take a bite and be like, oh, this is safe to eat. We have bitter taste buds on the back of our tongue because the regurgitative reflex is what sets us apart from a lot of other animals. That's what has allowed us to adapt to in a way that many other animals can't. If you can't regurgitate and you eat something poisonous, you're dead, okay? But because we have those bitter taste buds on the back of our tongue, it causes us to regurgitate even after eating something that was caustic or poisonous, and therefore we learn not to eat that again. And then we survive, we adapt, you know? That's why we have smell and taste. It wasn't so much for enjoyment as to a biological imperative to keep us safe. You know, does that make sense? Like, but you don't want to oversimplify it, because like I said, just based on your genetic background, you could have a plethora, a wide variance of different taste buds on your tongue, or you might have much less. There's also things called polymodal nociceptors, which are I'm going to say it again.
Big word, everybody.
It's two words.
Can you say it again?
Two words. Polymodal nociceptors. And those are taste buds that can actually excrete saliva. So those are designed for when you have something like mint or chili or spicy foods.
I get that when I drink some really high-proof bourbons, like where I immediately start salivating.
Yeah, and those are your polymodal nociceptors. They're reacting to that super hot things and trying to cool it down. They're saying, like, maybe you don't want to do this right now. Like,
but you do.
But you do, right? As we do. That's right. So everyone should have their third mark in front of them. I didn't want to get too scientific on everyone there, because that's just not sexy. Unless you're a science nerd with a fetish. I'm kidding. Jeez. All right. So this is the Pindaran...
Celt. Anybody picking up why this one is different than the other two right off the bat?
Is this peated?
Boom. Natalie with the win. So stick your nose in that glass. So we all know what peat is, right? Comes from peat bogs. It's essentially mud with enough vegetal matter in it that it'll burn. And do you know if this peat is sourced from whales?
So this is not peat inherent to the way that the barley is smoked. This is not peat from the water source. This is part of the whiskey and the vatting being finished in Lafroy Gorder casks. But it's finished in it for a little while. It's residual peat from the barrel, because they obviously, like you've already experienced from the first two expressions, it's a very light-bodied, nuanced whiskey, and a whole bunch of peat would overwhelm the F out of it, right? So what you have here is, you know, the funny thing to me is, and you know, however you feel about peated whiskeys, regardless, like, out of this range, and we still have get into the last two, Whiskey Advocate like picked this one just like last week as like one of their top 20 whiskeys of the year, and I was kind of like, yeah, I was like, wow. I was like, that one, really? Because honestly, to me, like, the one we're gonna taste next is just one of my favorite things that I've ever had. So that's just me. Whatever, it's all personal preference, obviously. But yes, this is their mildly peated expression, yeah. And it all comes secondary through the barrels that it's finished in.
So extraction from previous used cooperage. All the peat that's on this whiskey comes from a previous used barrel.
Nice.
So from
it's
the
nice.
Wood, not from peating of the grain, not from peat in the water source, okay? So
well,
something different.
Water. Funny you say that.
What's water source like? The water is all coming directly from an underground well in the area. It's very limestone heavy. Yeah, I mean, so they have a great water source. It's largely untapped in Wales because nobody's really making whiskey there, just not in any real volume yet. But, you know, Scotch distilleries often tout their water sources being about everything, you know. And certainly for those of you that are familiar with Japanese whiskeys, I mean, that that's kind of the whole thing about Japanese whiskey, is the water source being very different from what other single malt whiskeys or malt whiskeys in general are using. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they have a very limestone heavy water source. You know, they credit to leftover from the Ice Age, however many tens of thousands of years ago, contributing to what's just lying underground there. But yeah,
it's also because it's an island nation. The fresh water is caused just by being surrounded by salt water. Any volcanic activity on the island is going to be producing, you know, fresh water into the underwater river systems of that island. So what are you guys getting on this? You stick your nose in that glass, breathe in gently through your mouth.
There is a combination of first fill and next fill, and it depends what they're doing. Yeah, I mean, there's no one. There's an, oh, the Lefroy quarter casks. As far as I know, it's one time.
Yeah, this generally, if you're putting it, I mean, if the story is true about how hot this juice is going into the barrel, then it's going to be so extractive that after that, you're not going to have a lot of viable stuff. It's going to draw a huge amount of flavor out of the wood very quickly at that proof.
It has like this sherry oak cask smell to it. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but it does.
Any Madeira influence whatsoever could definitely register as that. I mean, as far as like being a fortified wine, like that sort of, is it a raisiny thing that you're talking about? Yeah, I mean, that's totally possible. They're not really clear on just how much Madeira influence each expression has. So my understanding is that it's a through line with everything.
But there's a great history to the use of Madeira casks, of course, because in the old world shipping routes, the Madeira wine from the Isle of Madeira was very popular to stop there, get some wine. It was fortified wine. So in the tradition of sherries and ports, Madeira is in that same world. And a lot of the old world casks would have been Madeira casks at that time. It would have been something that was a very, like, kind of a highly desired of the old world to be able to have a Madeira cask. You know, that would be a big deal. I'm getting like cherries and smoke on this one. I get that nice, like inky smoke that's lightly over the top of this big red fruit character, this wonderful, like fully rounded cherry smell. Meat?
Meaty.
Meaty, okay.
Meaty.
I was gonna say unctuous with
meat
the
peat.
Yeah, the peat.
Kind of like a bone more. Like,
yeah, it's an unctuous peat. It's nice, which is that Lefroy cask.
Yeah.
For sure. Smoked paprika, that's great.
It reminded me, like, sometimes I put, like, paprika and, like, chili on my cucumbers, and that's what it tastes like.
Ooh. Oh. Ooh, I really like this one. This is delicious.
It strikes me as a great peated scotch for a beginner.
That's great. Yeah, I agree.
I honestly, like...
You know, it's like, normally peated scotches are like cigars.
And smoked cigars.
Yeah, I don't have any... I mean, whatever. Everything is personal preference, right? And, like... I don't ever pick like heavily peated scotches to just drink out of enjoyment. It's not my thing. You know what I mean? The younger dudes and ladies that are getting into scotch are just like, oh, I just drink it smoky. And it's kind of the same thing that bothers me about like mezcal. I don't want to get into a whole agave thing right now, whatever, but it's just that thing where I'm like, I really, you know, like when you really kind of get into whiskey or mezcal for that matter, and you come to appreciate subtleties of a varietal, of a brand, or the techniques that they're doing, like a whole bunch of smoke on top of it is just kind of like, to me, gimmicky. I don't know, everybody's got their preferences, you know what I mean? And like, when you know, there are a lot of peaty brands out there that are peated to the point that your palate can't actually differentiate the parts per million anymore. It's the same thing with hopped beers and a lot of what's going on with like California IPAs and stuff like that. Like there are those ones out there that are like, what are the IBUs, bro? And like, you know, it's just kind of, you know, I mean, whatever. Like that's cool. This is, I just, you know, in terms of this brand, I mean, it's light bodied. It's not oily. We already kind of talked about that. And like, this is their peated expression, which is residual peat from a secondary barrel that they finished it in. I mean, you can see what they're going for.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's very, very approachable for a smoky scotch. I agree that would be a great entry level
for
someone who wants to try something peaty. Because it's not truly peaty.
But it's not even. It's not peaty. It's just a little smoke.
It's a tiny bit of smoke, yeah. So it's chocolatey too.
Clarify, you're not smoking or peating any of your.
No.
Barrel.
Yeah, that's all.
I agree. That's all barrel influence.
They pick specifically a quarter. Does everyone understand how size of a barrel will influence like the ratio of? Yeah. Okay, so. For the no's that are out there and aren't saying anything, just to be understood, I mean, the influence of a barrel is going to be directly proportionate to the ratio of surface area of the barrel against the spirit that's contained inside of the barrel, right? So essentially, like a regular size bourbon barrel,
53-gallon barrel,
right? So it will yield something in the neighborhood of, you think in terms of bottles this size. 250 to 325 bottles, maybe, of a regular size barrel, and when you reduce that to a quarter size, you're getting more contact from the wood to the spirit. So yes, they picked a heavily peated whiskey in a tiny little barrel, but then they put their spirit in that barrel for 3 to 6 months, and you know what you're getting is something that isn't intensely. You know, mossy.
Just real quickly, what he was talking about, quarter cask, is a much smaller barrel. Right. Much higher ratio of wood to whiskey, which is why you can get so much of a smoky influence with just using the wood, not having to smoke the grain or having a peaty water source. Does that make sense to everybody?
And they don't use a heavy char. It's not, and they're using, I mean, as far as the ex-bourbon goes, like, what is Buffalo Oak Trace, a number two?
Number four char. Yeah.
Is it really? Mm-hmm. That's super heavy. Okay, I didn't
but
know
it's
that.
Used. It's a used cooperage. They usually don't rechar for the most part. I mean, some companies, the big boys, some of the big boys are recharring, but they're also reassembling. So they're just kind of bringing it back. Well, yeah, some of the bigger Scotch distilleries are, they have their own cooperages on site where they'll do some repair and reviving of barrels. And some of the newer styles, what you've noticed in the last 5 years in the single malt world, is kind of gravitating in the direction of, at least for the whiskeys that we're getting here in America, obviously, they're trying to tailor the flavor of the single malts toward American whiskey drinkers, which we drink bourbon. So some use of first char barrels, things like Black Bush, you have these like whiskeys that are almost like hybrids because they're using charred oak barrels that are being used for the first time. They're recharring on location and then throwing their single malt scotch or throwing their Irish whiskey into that, essentially, a bourbon cask. So to me, that's kind of like a hybrid whiskey. You've got a traditional Irish or Scottish distillate being put into a bourbon process, meaning it's going to a first-use charred oak barrel. Does that make sense? So that what you're doing, every time when you rechar a barrel, you're re-caramelizing the sugars of the white oak tree. So you're going to get those more vanilla caramel tones. They're going to come out much stronger after that first fill. Also, the recharring of the barrel creates a charcoal filter, right? And then in the soakage, it's going in and out through that layer of char, which essentially is polishing your whiskey. And if you're recharring it, that makes it a stronger filtration or in the breathing process of the whiskey in and out of the wood, it creates a higher rate of filtration, which smooths your whiskey out even more. It might take away some of those younger whiskey notes by using a heavier char. Does that make sense? Cool, so I think Stephanie has successfully made it all the way around the room with this fourth mark. This is the Pindarin Madeira finish. And these bottles look very different. You can see they're a little different than the
original. Yeah, they released some new bottles. So the last two that we're gonna taste are the higher end expressions that are out in the market now. They are higher proof. They're a bit older. Let's not get crazy. You know what I mean? They got like another year or so. But they're still young whiskeys. This Madeira cask is wholly indicative of their house style. Everybody's impression is going to be different. I think the sort of forward tropical fruit thing that's going on with this expression is kind of undeniable. I mean, it's really...
So is this a full maturation in Madeira?
No. You know what's actually funny about this is that it's still a vatting. This particular expression actually has more bourbon influence than the Legend, which would be like sort of the junior partner to this one.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, it's really prevalent in terms of those notes that are coming from the Portuguese fortified wine, right? So
what are you guys getting on this Madeira cask finish here? Pandaren.
And then, like, salted plum.
Okay.
This one's really great as a highball. I'm just going to go ahead and say that. Yeah.
Yeah, some cherry. I'm getting some red fruit. Strong. I'm getting like a strawberry and dark chocolate going on here.
Macintosh apples for sure.
Chocolate bread pudding with some strawberries in there. That's what I'm getting here. This is pretty brilliant. And Josh, if I was going to get a bottle of this Pandaren Madeira cask, Madeira finish from my home bar, do you know what it's running in the local liquor stores?
That'd look like 70 to 75, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's beautiful whiskey.
Legend will run between 45 and 50, depending on the store. Myth and Celt will be the same price. And will be in the neighborhood of like 55 to 60. Like I said, this one that we're tasting right now will run in the range of like 70, 75. And the last one we're gonna taste is a little bit higher than that. So
we've got this last expression here. So clean the glass. We're gonna come around with this final, Natalie. Beautiful. And this is the previous was the Madeira finish.
And this is the sherry wood, which
sherry
is the
finish.
Which All is right. a the sherry wood is a very recent release in the U.S. And as the name suggests, there's Oloroso sherry cask finish.
Finished in an Oloroso sherry cask. Tell us about this expression, Josh.
And it's not, as with a lot of the Pandaren, it's perhaps important to understand that part of the whiskey in this expression, part of the vatting, part of it previous to that, is finished in Oloroso sherry cask. So with any of them, it's always about lighter, not heavy-handed influences. Have you ever had an unbelievably sherried malt whiskey? I like them personally, but they're not for everybody, just like a heavily peated one is not for everybody, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's meant to be approachable. It is not like
heavily sherry.
Not drinking like a cask strength sherry for that matter.
So yeah, there's in the last several years, I mean, after Yamazaki won World's Best Whiskey with their sherry cask finish, I think there was a whole year of like sherry bombs that were dropping all over the place. Everybody was putting out these single malts that were so heavily sherry that you put them up to your nose and it was just like this red fruit perfume, you know, it was really, really intense. And for my palate, too sweet. I personally would gravitate in the direction of a smokier scotch than a heavily sherried scotch, myself. But everyone's palate's different. But stick your nose in this glass, breathe in gently through your mouth.
I'm getting leather.
Leather. I always get a nuttiness from that Oloroso, so I get like cashews and cherries.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's still a real presence of bourbon cask in this one, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's not. It's not like
that's that leather.
That's kind of leather. I associate those.
That's a bourbon note for sure. That beautiful.
I mean, have you ever had like a
oak quality?
Have you ever had like a Michel Couvreur like whiskey bottling?
Oh, what?
Michel Couvreur, like it's
Who's
a.
That?
Is anybody like?
Are those words?
So he's a bottler from France that has since passed away, and like
it's a cognac background.
And like the whiskeys are not like a fully it's 100% sherry cask and it's like just dripping with raisins. That's not what this is. It's nuanced. It's interesting. It's got.
What are you getting at there, guys? Yeah, tell me what food words come to mind as you tap this over your tongue. Share your experience. No wrong answers.
Dry red fruit leather, like the fruit leathers that you'd get.
The organic kind, though.
Mm-hmm.
Plum wine, okay.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I'm getting some nice milk chocolate on the finish. It's like very, very nice. Well, right on. So hopefully we were able to turn you on to a new favorite friend tonight, some rare Welsh whiskey. Josh, thanks for bringing these out tonight.
Hey, thank you guys.
It's
thank
really,
you guys.
Really great to have you, as usual.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you heard, please head over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and review. The Spirit Guide Society is a Spirit Adventures production in association with Bitten from the Apple Productions. Special thanks to Tone Mesa for their post-production and audio services. The show is produced by Andrew Apple and me, Pedro Shanahan. Executive producer, Andrew Abrahamson. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Spirit Guide SOC. We'll be there to answer any questions you have, share what we're drinking, and more. And if you're still thirsty, you can always find more episodes of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to always drink responsibly. That means don't drink to forget, drink to remember.